From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. You may have heard actress Zooey Deschanel sing in the movie Elf. She took her act on stage, and she's on tour this summer with indie rock musician M. Ward. Their band is called She and Him. On today's Fresh Air, we'll talk with Deschanel and listen to her CD. The Dark Knight is the latest in the Batman movie series. It opens next week. Later in today's show, we'll hear from Bob Kane, the cartoonist who created the original Batman character. Also, film critic David Edelstein reviews The Wackness, starring Ben Kingsley, and I'll have a review of Generation Kill. It's the new HBO miniseries about the war in Iraq from the creators of The Wire. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David B. Cooley of broadcasting and cable magazine and TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. Actress Zooey Deschanel is on movie screens right now as one of the stars of The Happening. But that's not the only place you can see her this summer. You can also see her live, singing, on tour with her band. It's not always good news when an actor decides to make a record. But in Zooey Deschanel's case, it is. You may have gotten a taste of her singing in the movie Elf, in which she starred opposite Will Ferrell. Her other movies include Almost Famous and All the Real Girls, and she's appeared on the Showtime series Weeds and starred in the Sci-Fi Channel miniseries Tin Man. She recently teamed up with indie rock musician Matt Ward, who goes by the name M. Ward. Their first CD, called She and Him Volume 1, features her original songs and a couple of covers. She and Him also is the name of their band. The arrangements are by Ward, who is also featured on guitar. Here's one of Deschanel's originals, Change is Hard.
I'm all out of luck, but what else could I be? I know he's yours and he'll never.
Zooey Deschanel, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Congratulations on the new CD. I really love it. When I hear your album, here's one of the things I think about that makes me think that you really love music and have a fairly diverse record collection, and that you love country music and you love jazz and you love girl groups and the Beach Boys, and somehow like all of this is reflected in the songs that you write and sing. The song that we open with, Change is Hard, has a country-ish sound to it.
Mm-hmm.
And would you talk a little bit about what you were thinking about when you wrote it? What you were thinking about musically? Or do songs just kind of come to you?
I don't know. I guess I have certain sort of chord progressions that I'm attracted to. I don't usually come at it from the point of view that I'm trying to be in a certain genre, which is probably why it sort of spans a lot of genres, because I do have a diverse music collection and my taste is kind of eclectic. So I'll just go right into it and sort of start writing. It's sort of a spontaneous thing. And sometimes things come out that I'm surprised. I didn't know that I had that impulse in me, and then it just sort of comes out.
You used to have a cabaret act, right, before you were well-known in movies. What was that like?
It was just basically a friend of mine, another actress whose name is Samantha Shelton, and I had a cabaret act, and it was basically just jazz standards, and we'd do a little dancing, and we had a 5 or 6 piece band, depending upon who was in town, and it was just kind of something that I liked to do when I wasn't working on movies. And I love to sing, and I love performing for people a lot in a live setting. It does different things for you than, doing movies. You don't get the feeling of a live audience because the crew is always just so bored of what you're doing. And they're not allowed to laugh or do anything audibly to show that they're enjoying what you're doing. So it's nice to have an audience there.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Zooey Deschanel. And of course, she's an actress, but she also sings and writes songs. There's some great evidence of that on the new CD, She and Him, which features her and M. Ward together collaborating. I think a lot of people were introduced to you as a singer through the movie Elf, in which you sang a complete song and a couple of excerpts, including Santa Claus is Coming to Town. So here's what I'd like to do. I'd like to first play the scene where you and Will Ferrell meet. And Will Ferrell, of course, is a human being who was adopted by elves in Santaland in the North Pole. And he goes to New York to find his birth father. And there he works in a department store, Santaland, where he meets you, who wrap gifts there. And in this scene, you're in the department store, and here's you and Will Ferrell.
Are you enjoying the view?
You are very good at decorating that tree.
Why are you messing with me? Did Krampa put you up to this?
I'm not messing with you. It's just nice to meet another human who shares my affinity for elf culture.
I'm just trying to get through the holidays.
Get through? Christmas is the greatest day in the whole wide world!
Please stop talking to me.
Uh-oh. Sounds like someone needs to sing a Christmas carol.
No way.
Best way to spread Christmas cheer is singing loud for all to hear.
Thanks, but I don't sing.
Well, it's easy. It's just like talking, except louder and longer, and you move your voice up and down.
I can sing, but I just choose not to sing, especially in front of other people.
Well, if you sing alone, you can sing in front of other people. There's no difference.
Actually, there's a big difference.
Well, that's Zooey Deschanel and Will Ferrell in Elf. And a little later, you think, alone and singing. You're in the shower singing in the ladies' room, and unbeknownst to you, Will Ferrell is in the ladies' room sitting on a sink, duetting with you quietly, and the sound of the shower water is drowning him out, so you don't realize he's in there and singing with you until the end. So let's give that a listen.
So really I'd better scurry. Well, maybe just a half a drink more. The neighbors might think
better thing.
Say, what's in this drink? I wish I knew how to break the spell.
I'll take your head, your hair.
I ought to say no, no, no.
Mind if I move in?
At least I'm gonna say that I tried.
What's the sense of hurting my pride?
I really can't stay.
Baby, it's cold outside.
And then you turn off the shower because you're pretty alarmed knowing that he's in there. It's such a really delightful scene. You know, in Elf, you say that singing is really private. Like, yeah, you can sing, but you don't sing in front of anybody. Mm. And I get the impression that writing songs for you is really private. And so it was maybe a little difficult initially to sing the songs you wrote in public. Was that more difficult than singing Rodgers and Hart in public?
Yeah, actually, it was really... I was really, really shy about it for a really long time. I mean, I've been writing music for years and years, but I would just sort of make these home demos elaborate for me. It would be like, you know, I mean, I would spend a long time on them and then I would just let them sort of sit around. And it got to the point where I just had so many and they were starting to sort of drive me crazy. And I mean, in the sense that I wanted so badly to do something with them, but I felt crippled by shyness about them. And it wasn't until I met Matt that I really felt like I had found, you know, just the right person to work with on this stuff.
Did he get you to hear your own songs differently?
Definitely, definitely. I mean, there were songs that I was like, oh, this is just a little ditty. And he was like, no, it's not. We have to make this into a, you know, big production. So it was really, it was fun to see. I mean, and then there were some things that I had written as, you know, bigger things, and then he made them more spare. And then some of them were exactly how I pictured, but he definitely gave me a new perspective.
And was Sentimental Heart one of the songs that he changed in your mind?
Well, actually, that was interesting because it was the first song we recorded, and I was really nervous. And we were recording in studio in Portland with this engineer named Mike Kirkendall, who's really great, and he played a lot of the instruments on the record too. And we recorded my voice and piano at the same time first, and Mike sort of had filtered it through an echo effect where you record the echo on the voice, and it made it sound really sort of lo-fi. And then at the end, we were all sort of I can't remember exactly what happened, but the idea sort of came spontaneously to make the ending hi-fi, like to have this song that sounds very innocent and very modest, and then have it sort of introduced into a new world where...
the Beach Boys world.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, that's just the end of that. That's me playing drums at the end, which I was proud of.
So let's hear the latter part of the opening track of She and Him. This is Sentimental Heart, written and sung by my guest Zoe Deschanel, who is also featured on drums.
Cried all night till there was nothing more. What you sent my eyes, a heap on the floor. Heaving devotion, but it's just no good. Taking it hard, just like you knew.
Zoe Deschanel, who spoke to Terry Gross earlier this year. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview, recorded earlier this year, with actress and now singer Zoe Deschanel. Her CD with M. Ward is called She and Him, Volume 1.
Now, you got your first movie role when you were still in high school, and I think you left high school the last month of your senior year to shoot the movie Mumford. Mm-hmm. What did you like or not like about that experience? I mean, obviously, you decided to stay in that world as a movie actress.
Well, I had an amazing experience, and I was still I was finishing school. I finished high school on set, and then it was sort of I didn't know that I would get into acting so early. I thought that it would be something that I did after college. I was all set to go to Northwestern University, and then I auditioned for that movie, and I got it, and I went up to Santa Rosa to shoot it, and then I had an amazing experience, a wonderful time working with Lawrence Kasdan. The director was it was a perfect first experience because every day we'd shoot, 14 or 16 hours, and I'd be like, I love this. I never want to go home. I would get sad when they'd be like, okay, you're done for the day. And I would be like, really, already? And it was so much fun that I didn't want to go home. That was a great experience. And then I went to Northwestern University for a year. And partway through the year, I auditioned for Cameron Crowe on my spring break. And they were casting this movie, Almost Famous, and somebody had fallen out of the, they had it cast, but it was, but the lead actress decided not to do it. And then Kate Hudson was supposed to play the part of the kid's sister. And then he bumped her up to the lead role. And then there was this empty role and they were about to shoot. And I auditioned for it. And I found out that I had, you know, booked the job, and I shipped all my stuff home from school and on a just sort of a impulse.
Well, you did good. Let's hear your first scene in Almost Famous. You're walking in the door. You're still living with your mother. You're 18. Your mother's played by Frances McDormand. As you walk in, you're wearing this like big coat, and you're kind of holding it shut as if you're covering something up. So you walk in, your mother greets you at the door, and your little brother, who ends up growing up and writing for Rolling Stone, is standing in the room also, listening.
You've been kissing.
No, I haven't.
Yes, you have.
No, I haven't.
Yes, you have. I can tell.
You can't tell.
Not only can I tell, I know who it is. It's Daryl. What you got under your coat?
It's unfair that we can't listen to our music.
It's because it is about drugs and promiscuous sex.
Simon and Garfunkel is poetry.
Yes, it's poetry. It is a poetry of drugs and promiscuous sex. Honey, they're on pot.
First it was butter, then it was sugar and white flour, bacon, eggs, bologna, rock and roll, motorcycles. Then it was celebrating Christmas on a day in September when you knew it wouldn't be commercialized. What else are you gonna ban?
Honey, you want to rebel against knowledge. I'm trying to give you the cliff notes on how to live life in this world.
We're like nobody else I know.
I am a college professor. Why can't I teach my own kids? Use me.
Daryl says that you use knowledge to keep me down. He says I'm a yes person and you are trying to raise us in a no environment.
Well, clearly, no is a word Daryl doesn't hear much.
I can't live here! I hate you! Even William hates you!
I don't hate her.
You do hate her. You don't even know the truth.
Sweetheart, don't be a drama queen.
You!
Hey!
This is a house of lies!
That's Zooey Deschanel and Frances McDormand in a scene from Almost Famous, which was Zooey Deschanel's second movie. So, you know, here's something odd that I read. You know, you were supposed to play Janis Joplin in a movie directed by Penelope Spheeris, who's made a bunch of movies about punk rock. And I right. thought, wow, that seems so wrong to me. You have such a kind of clear, pure voice, and she had so much kind of growl in hers, and your body types are completely different. Like, what were you thinking? What were they thinking?
I think that it was, they were looking for somebody who was an actress who also could sing, and I was thinking that it would be a really fun challenge to try to portray this person. I mean, our voices, yes, are very different, and we were actually supposed to go like a year and a half ago. We were all set to make it, and then it fell through due to a lot of sort of logistical things that I don't think I quite understand at this point, but it was a lot of work. I worked for like 6 months. I mean, it's definitely very different from who I am, but I really found her to be an interesting person once I sort of started looking into who she was.
So I have to ask you about your name. You were named Zooey after Franny and Zooey, the mm-hmm. famous J.D. Salinger story, which so many people have read. How old were you when you read the story, and did you like it well enough to feel good about being named after after the character. Because probably throughout your life, people have been saying, oh, you're named after Franny and Zoe. So yeah. So how old were you when you read the story, and do you like it?
I actually waited a really long time to read it, because I had read all of J.D. Salinger's other works, and I was sort of terrified that I wouldn't like it, and that I would be living with this, you know, identity of a person who doesn't like their namesake. But fortunately, I loved it when I read it. I was 18 when I read it. I read it the summer after I graduated from high school. My older sister was named after Emily Dickinson and Emily Bronte, and they wanted me to have a literary name too. And I think they liked the name Zoe, and they just decided to spell it that way, as you know, they love J.D. Salinger and they love that book. So I think that's why.
Well, they certainly chose a different period and different form of writing than your sister.
It's true.
Well, Zoe Deschanel, thanks so much for talking with us, and you know, good luck with your new CD.
And, thank you.
Yeah, thank you again.
It was really nice talking to you. Thank you.
Zoe Deschanel speaking to Terry Gross earlier this year. Later this month, Deschanel's band She and Him will start their summer tour. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Saw your face, my hand you took, just like in a storybook, and you've got me.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, presenting daily book reviews, author interviews, and more in the Barnes & Noble Review, online at bn.com. From the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, celebrating 10 years of support for the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. And from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Details are at GatesFoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, The Dark Knight, the latest Batman movie, opens next week. We hear from Bob Kane, creator of the original Batman. Also, film critic David Edelstein reviews The Wackness, and I'll preview Generation Kill, the upcoming HBO miniseries dramatizing the opening days and weeks of the ground assault in Iraq. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli. The Wackness is a semi-autobiographical film by the young writer-director Jonathan Levine, set in New York City in 1994. The film stars Josh Peck and co-stars, as a pot-smoking psychiatrist, Sir Ben Kingsley. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
Jonathan Levine's The Wackness unfolds in New York City in 1994, and it's a weave of two fat thematic strands. A late teenager's coming-of-age story, he's a drug dealer, so not your standard fresh-faced protagonist, and a portrait of a city and a culture in the throes of transition. Those strands don't mesh, but the film has real wit and an undertow of melancholy. It wears its heart on its hero's baggy jeans. The kid is named Luke and played by Josh Peck of Nickelodeon's excruciating, at least for non-tweens, sitcom Drake and Josh. At the moment, he sells pot, wheels it around the city in a beat-up ice cream cart. There are no cell phones back then, so he's isolated, and he broods over his lack of popularity in high school. Josh is one of those upper-middle-class 90s white kids who embraced the slang of hip-hoppers, appropriating the rage of the African-American underclass for their own ends. Levine uses Luke's hip-hop lingo satirically, but he also suggests that the music is a life-saving outlet for his pain, as well as an alternative to Kurt Cobain, who just offed himself. Peck is too much of a mouth breather. He doesn't need to let his mouth hang open all the time. But his passion suggests a minor key variation on John Cusack's great Lloyd Dobler in Say Anything. He narrates in a distinctive patois.
But I don't need high school friends. One week they're listening to Criss Cross, the next they're listening to Pearl Jam. I'm not like that. I'm loyal. I mean, I still listen to cassettes. But tomorrow, my life changes. Tomorrow, I graduate. And then I go to my safety school. And then I get older. And then I die.
Luke's dad is going broke. His family on the verge of eviction. His only confidant, his psychiatrist, Dr. Squires, a late middle-aged hippie, played by a weirdly cast, though very funny, Sir Ben Kingsley. We're in the twilight of Freudian psychotherapy here, when the rise of antidepressant medication is making this disillusioned doctor all but give up.
So what's on your mind, Luke?
Nothing. I can make something up.
Fine. Make something up, then.
Okay. I'm having trouble getting laid.
Common problem. Have you ever gotten laid?
2 years ago, Katie Randall in Battery Park. But she had drank like 240 ounces, and the cops came and broke us up before we...
So, she was drunk.
Homegirl weighs like 60 pounds, and she drank 2 40-ounce bottles of Crazy Horse.
Crazy Horse.
Look, Dr. Squires.
Call me Jeff.
Look, Jeff. Dr. Squires. How much you need, man?
You're the one who needs this, son.
There's so much in those excerpts. Luke's self-hatred and pride in his own integrity. His therapist's cynicism. He gets pot from his patient. And his vision of a better future for this kid. That's before he knows that Luke has the hots for his stepdaughter, played by a willowy Olivia Thirlby, the second banana in Juno. No, it's more than the hots. He falls in love with her. And we see his crash coming a mile away. In 1994, the crack cocaine epidemic was easing, and there are references in the Wackness to new mayor Rudy Giuliani's crackdown on quality of life crimes, sweeping the homeless off streets, running dealers out of parks. But as the non-love story goes on and on, the Giuliani subplot peters out. The Wackness has what a friend of mine once called the spread of nonfiction. It isn't shaped. But that might be in part because Levine doesn't believe in easy resolutions, certainly not after high school graduation. The core of the Wackness is the bond between the bitter therapist and the kid who wants to sleep with his stepdaughter. It's strange, funny, off-putting, and finally moving, a once-in-a-lifetime union. And watching Kingsley stick his tongue down the throat of Mary-Kate Olsen as a free-spirited hippie, one of Luke's customers, at a bar, is one of the weird sights of the year. Even the queen might say, "Sir Ben, that is whack."
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Coming up, Shedding Light on the Dark Knight, a conversation with Bob Kane, the cartoonist who created Batman almost 70 years ago. This is Fresh Air. The Dark Knight, the second installment in the latest cinematic incarnation of the costume crime fighter known as the Batman, opens next Friday. Christian Bale returns as Bruce Wayne, the billionaire with a villain-hunting alter ego, and Michael Caine once again plays his loyal butler, Alfred.
People are dying, Alfred. What would you have me do?
Endure, Master Wayne. Take it. They'll hate you for it, but that's the point of Batman. He can be the outcast. He can make the choice that no one else can make. The right choice.
Well, today I found out what Batman can't do. He can't endure this. Today you get to say I told you so.
Today I don't want to.
Next year will mark the 70th anniversary of the Batman character. Cartoonist Bob Kane created the character in 1939 when he was a teenager. Batman has been in continuous publication ever since. Kane drew Batman himself for DC Comics until 1966, the year the TV series premiered, and took a camp pop art approach to the character. When Bob Kane gave up drawing Batman comics, he started painting Batman on canvas. Kane died in 1998. In 1990, Terry Gross talked to him and asked about the creation of the Caped Crusader.
Why did you make Batman someone without superpowers? I mean, he was a regular mortal who was very, very fit and very clever, but he didn't really have superpowers like Superman did.
Exactly. For one thing, I didn't want to emulate Superman and imitate it because I thought maybe they wouldn't want that. And I wanted to come up with something original, for one thing. And secondly, I felt that every person that doesn't have superpowers could relate to Batman a lot easier than they could to Superman. In other words, you didn't have to come from another planet to be a superhero. All you had to do was be born rich and build your body into perfection and have the urge to go out and fight crime. So most people like the idea that Batman never had superpowers. They can relate to him a lot quicker than to a superhero with superpowers.
Now, here you were, a Jewish kid growing up in the Bronx, right? Your superhero is named Bruce Wayne. I mean, what a very not-Jewish name.
Well, it's an alliteration of Bob Kane.
Oh, okay.
Bruce Wayne.
Well,
alliteration. I wanted it to sound... I wanted to be Bruce Wayne in my reverie and in my daydreams. I felt, instead of a poor kid, I imagined I'd like to be a rich playboy and fight crime at night. Because I hate all injustices in the world.
Would it have been possible to have made a Jewish superhero, or was that out of the question at the time?
Well, only for the Jewish Forward, which is a newspaper in the Bronx. But that's the only paper that would take a Jewish hero.
Tell me why you decided to draw Batman in tights and shorts. Now, I know Superman was drawn that way.
Well, actually, it's called the Union Suit character. And for whatever reason, Superman started it, and it seemed to work. And mine was second, except I used a bat cape and the bat symbols, the bat mystique, which spread out into the bat cave, the batmobile, the batarang, and so forth. I used the entire bat mystique to create my bat world. Superman only had a telephone booth. So mine is really more merchandisable, so to speak, and also more mysterioso. Yeah, somehow you enhance an idea. You begin with it. It's just a germ of an idea. And as I studied the history of comics in America, all the comics heroes were very crude at the beginning, and they developed along the way. Like Dick Tracy didn't have a two-way wristwatch when he started. That came along later.
You started off doing slapstick comics, and then turned to Batman. How did your drawing style change to create the Batman mood?
Well, I was a very good copyist, Terry, and I was able to copy superheroes at an early age. At 15, I could copy Flash Gordon almost as well as the artist who drew him, Alex Raymond. And I used to dabble in copying all the comics, slapstick as well as the illustrative kind. And the reason for my adaptation and switching over to the illustrative art rather than slapstick art was simply because there was more money in the superhero. Like when I asked Vincent Sullivan how much money the Superman artists were making, they were making $1,600 between them during any given week, and I was making $25. So I did that because of the money, basically. Intrinsically, I really would rather draw slapstick comics. I've always been a great lover of the early Mutt and Jeff and Popeye and Maggie and Chigs, and those were the comics that I grew up on that I wanted to emulate and become a slapstick comic artist, but I realized that the illustrative superhero was probably my forte for making money and fame.
Batman was obviously inspired by the success of Superman. What was the reaction initially of the Superman artists to Batman? Did they think that you were just stealing from them?
No, not really, because Batman really was nothing like Superman in costume or in the general genre. Superman came from Krypton, another planet, and he had superpowers. He could fly and leap great heights over buildings, where Batman was merely a mortal that wore a bat costume. And no, they weren't surprised, because they knew that there would be a whole slew of imitative superheroes to come, and mine was second. And frankly, Terry, after Batman and Superman, there really wasn't another original superhero in the last 50 years. All they are offshoots, in one way or another, of the costumes, of new costumes based on Superman and Batman. A few of them don't have superpowers like Bruce Wayne, Batman. Most of them do have superpowers, but nobody other than Spider-Man, which came along about 25 years later, and it's kind of a unique character, and it looks like a spider. It's amazing, though, how all the characters other than Superman took on the names of insects, animals, and so forth, if you want to analyze it.
Did you ever see a bat when you were growing up?
Well, I had great fears of bats. And therein lies an amazing dichotomy also. The fact that who thought any character with a name like a Batman would go, only because even my publisher at that time thought it was a very ominous name, and he suggested I change it. And I said, well, why don't we try one issue and we'll see how it goes. But when the issue sold out and I came to him and I said, well, what about changing the name? Let's call him Irving Schwartz the Tailor, or whatever. He laughed and he said, no, let's keep the name, because, you know, obviously the bottom line in any industry, in motion pictures and comic books, is money. If you're making money, you stay with it.
You drew Batman for DC Comics. You stayed with that house. What are some of the pros and cons of doing a comic for a comic book house like that? Who owns the rights to the characters, for instance?
Unfortunately, that's part of the negative part of the business, is that when you're young, you sell away your copyrights, and actually that happens with most of the cartoonists, and they own the character at that time, and I couldn't take it elsewhere. And actually, I was making very good money, and in 1940-41, I was making practically $1,000 a week. And so you're not about to leave, and $1,000 a week in 1940 was comparable to about $5,000, $6,000 today a week. And so being that they owned the copyright, I did the best I could at the time by compromising and getting a good piece of the action and a perpetuity contract. So therefore, I did rather well compared to some artists who sold it away and didn't get very much out of it.
Have you owned a piece of the merchandising over the years?
Yes, I do. Mm-hmm. Yes, I do rather well.
I'll bet, yeah.
I mean, all things being equal, I'd love to own it, and I would have done 1,000% better, but I didn't do badly the way it turned out, and life is a compromise. If it weren't for the publisher, I probably, I never would have been where I am today. So, you know, one hand washes the other.
Just briefly, can you tell us what you thought of the movie Batman? You were a consultant to that.
Yes, I was project consultant, and I did add a lot of my input. I drew the costumes. I said the costume has to be rigged with wire that when he jumps through a skylight, it'll billow out behind him like a bat. And I critiqued the script and so forth. I thought it was very true to the roots of Batman, the way I started it, whence it came. In other words, Batman had gone back to the Mysterioso, dark, brooding Batman that I created in the early years. I love the campy version, but I really prefer the dark, brooding version. And I think the sets were marvelous. The whole mood of the movie had a different film noir look. And look, it grossed over $250 million. It's one of the all-time top grosses in Hollywood from the time of its inception. And in Europe, it'll probably make another $200 million. And plus the merchandising and the video cassettes, the Batman could very well go to $1 billion. That's more than any movie ever earned or ever will earn in the history of movies. And I love the movie. I thought it just was true to my original dark brooding. I was just worried it shouldn't turn into a campy TV show again, and it did not. It followed faithfully my early mood of the genre of Batman.
Bob Kane, speaking to Terry Gross in 1990. He died in 1998. Next week, director Christopher Nolan takes his second shot at the Batman legend. And playing the Joker is the late Heath Ledger, in a performance that crackles with energy and originality. Here he is, as the ghoulishly made-up Joker, crashing a society party looking for a hated adversary, District Attorney Harvey Dent.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We are tonight's entertainment.
I only have one question. Where is Harvey Dent? You know where Harvey is? Do you know who he is?
Do you know where I can find Harvey? I need to talk to him about something. Just something little, huh? No. You know, I'll settle for his loved ones.
We're not intimidated by thugs.
You know, you remind me of my father. I hated my father.
The late Heath Ledger, playing the Joker in a scene from The Dark Knight, the new Batman movie that opens next week. Coming up, I review Generation Kill, the new HBO miniseries from the creators of The Wire. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm TV critic David Bianculli of TVWorthWatching.com. If the history of war dramas about Iraq is any guide, HBO's new Generation Kill has a tough campaign ahead in the battle to interest viewers. Over There, an excellent FX drama about the current Iraq war, came and went in 2005 without most people watching or noticing, even though Stephen Bochco was one of its producers. And if you look at the box office results for movies about the current conflict in Iraq and Afghanistan, most of them have, well, pardon the expression, tanked. Even A Mighty Heart with Angelina Jolie and The Kingdom with Jamie Foxx. On TV, viewers have tended to accept shows about war only after those wars have cooled a bit in memory. World War II dramas like Combat didn't show up until about 20 years later in the 1960s. MASH was a huge hit during the Vietnam War, but despite its obvious parallels and parables, it was set during the Korean War from a previous decade. The first successful shows actually about Vietnam, China Beach and Tour of Duty, didn't appear until the mid-1980s. And perhaps in that respect, Generation Kill may have an edge that Over There, 3 years ago, did not. 3 years later, our national mood is measurably different. And Generation Kill plays the nostalgia card as much as it can by dramatizing the opening days and weeks of the ground assault in Iraq. Those were the days of shock and awe, the days of mission accomplished, the days of expecting grateful citizens to wave as tanks and Humvees rolled into Baghdad. Generation Kill throws us into the conflict through the perspective of Evan Wright, a reporter from Rolling Stone who's attached to the 1st Reconnaissance Battalion of the Marines. Lee Turkerson, from Oz, plays the reporter. And he experiences the war as the ground-level soldiers do, on and around the front lines. And, with an increasing sense of confusion and frustration, as missions lead to nowhere and supplies don't arrive from anywhere. After a poorly planned military maneuver leads to the destruction of supply trucks, one of the company commanders gathers his Marines to give them a pep talk. The heat is unbearable. The flies are inescapable. And the message, as we hear after the company is dismissed and the soldiers talk among themselves, is received with sarcasm.
And I know you're mad at the battalion, because as you know, I've been talking to you and I've heard you. And I know you're angry. I know you're angry that the supply truck was burned and you don't have that food to eat. You told me this, and I heard you. But you shouldn't be angry at your command. If you're angry at your command, then you're saying that it was our fault that the supply truck was burned. But we didn't burn the supply truck. The enemy burned the supply truck. They took your food from you. That's the important thing to remember. It was the enemy who stole your food from you, and you should be really, really mad at them. Before we step off on this next mission, I'm reminding you of who your enemy is. The enemy.
Thank you, sir. Company! Ate! Hunt! Fall out!
I'm in awe.
There's a lot that Generation Kill gets right. It's definitely worth watching, because it unfolds the same way HBO's Band of Brothers did. Like that miniseries about World War II, Generation Kill confines the action to the soldiers carrying out the orders and shows the generals and other top-ranked officers only when they interact directly with their troops. The budget is bigger than in Over There, so the battle scenes and the scenery are more convincing. But the scope, in a way, is bigger too, and I'm not sure Generation Kill handles that as well as it could have. We're supposed to follow the action and the characters, not only in the vehicle carrying Turgeson's embedded reporter, but in 4 other primary vehicles. With everyone in fatigues or camouflage, and spending a lot of time under helmets or behind gun sights, it's not always easy to tell the players, even with a scorecard. But some performances do rise to the top. HBO provided 5 of the 7 episodes for preview. In those 5, there are several standouts. They include Alexander Skarsgård as Iceman, Billy Lush as the trigger-happy Trombley, Chance Kelly as the gravel-voiced lieutenant colonel known as the Godfather, and, as journalist Evan Wright, the always reliable Turgeson. The real Evan Wright is one of the writers on Generation Kill, along with David Simon and Ed Burns from The Wire. Simon and Burns get to chase their favorite obsessions here, too. They love to explore complicated and often contradictory characters, and the mechanisms of various power structures that either solve problems or perpetuate them. There's plenty of all that in Generation Kill. Should people watch this miniseries? Yes. It's not as polished or as good as Band of Brothers, but it's a very strong drama. Will people watch this miniseries? Except for a million or two, I'm guessing they won't. But in this case, I applaud HBO for trying. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. Our digital production project supervisor is Julian Hirschfeld. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley. We'll end today with music from drummer Bobby Durham, who died on Monday in Italy at the age of 71. Durham was born in Philadelphia and played with a number of jazz greats, including Duke Ellington, Dizzy Gillespie, Lionel Hampton, Ella Fitzgerald, and Roy Haynes. He also led his own trio, and here they are, recorded in the last decade of his career.
Support for NPR comes from the Wallace Foundation, whose Knowledge Center is where education leaders can go to learn about improving teaching and learning. Downloads at wallacefoundation.org. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. And from Bantam Books, publisher of Conquistador, A History of Hernan Cortez, King Montezuma, and The Last Stand of the Aztecs by Buddy Levy. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Barack Obama's political roots in Chicago. We talk with Ryan Lizza, who's been following the Obama campaign for the New Yorker magazine. Join us for the next Fresh Air.